Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I knew too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international system. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth adds to the...
But you're...
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, online only, streaming live for the first time since we were removed from FM in the lockdown. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's the Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, the fuse is lit for World War III in Hong Kong as China decides to impose strict rules against public gatherings in Hong Kong once the pandemic is over. The new national security law being enacted at this weekend's Chinese Communist Party Congress means criticism of President Xi, as well as failure to respect the flag or the national anthem, be a crime, as will be any discussion of extending democracy or independence for Hong Kong. Well, some Hong Kongers are petrified, having seen surprise arrests as many of their pro-democracy leaders during the lockdown, an unprecedented censorship by YouTube as well this week, and social media, of some of the expert views on the lockdown. Those views ignored by the mass media generally, and we hear from two tonight, Dr. Knut Witkowski and Dolores Cahill, both pandemic experts arguing against the hard lockdown that we've seen in much of the West. Also censored has been Max Egan's mind-blowing report with hard evidence that the March 2019 Christchurch mosque massacre may have been a military operation rather than done by a so-called lone wolf. We hear from his report, which YouTube censored. The shooter's manifesto is banned in New Zealand, but there on the title page was the Nazi Black Sun. We hear from Portuguese artist and researcher Arith Hager. What was this Black Sun? Also, Bristol's famous atomic spy, Klaus Fuchs, who leaked the atomic bomb plans to Stalin's Russia in the 1940s. Plus, more incredible evidence, the Nazis may have got there first with the atom bomb. Classified documents only released 70 years after the war, says Joseph Farrell, as he shows in his book, interestingly named The Reich of the Black Sun. And finally, the Zionists, who we are not allowed to criticise, links to Satanism and plans for a world government and world religion. That's according to US writer, also censored by YouTube, James Perloff. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Joining me to review this week's news, though, is Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's Steve Smith. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thank you.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Steve? Well, what's your background and why are you a Tory?
I've been a councillor for Westbury and Henley's for the last couple of years, having come in a by-election in 2018. I've lived here in Westbury and Bristol for the last 16 years now, I think, with my wife and my two kids. I work in my day job as a freelance bid manager, helping mainly small companies bid for government work. Outside of that, I'm a bit of a serial volunteer, so I spend a lot of time volunteering with scouts locally, obviously slightly curtailed at the moment. I also volunteer riding blood bikes, which is great fun, riding around on motorbikes with blue lights and sirens, delivering emergency blood for the NHS. And I'm also a magistrate in Bristol Magistrates Court, so keeping busy.
Can you tell us a bit about your work with the scouts? Have the scouts simply just not been able to meet at all, including the leaders, for the last 2 months?
Not in person, no. The last meeting we had, or personally anyway, was the Monday that the first kind of semi-lockdown was announced. We actually met that evening, and whilst we were in the meeting, we got an email from Scouts headquarters saying, that's it, we are closed down, don't meet face to face. But there's been a lot of stuff going on. We meet via Zoom now, and it's amazing how much you can do remotely like that. I've seen all sorts of people having, you know, remote camps. Everyone camps in their own back garden and just shares a campfire via Zoom and all kinds of stuff going on. So there's still stuff happening. And it has brought home to me, actually, how much, I don't consider myself that old at 42, but the teenagers I work with are absolutely digital natives, and this stuff is natural to them, whereas to me, it's always been something that I've learned later in life.
I wonder what you make, because, I mean, this has fallen particularly harshly on children and young people, this lockdown. How have your own children been coping?
They're doing okay. One of them is perfectly happy and would quite happily spend all day sat on a sofa with a computer if you let them. The other's a bit more gregarious and would like to be out with their mates. But, well, no, they're doing okay, like all of us. You know, I think people are amazingly adaptable.
Are they missing school, or are they pleased to have this extra long extended holiday?
If you ask them, they say, no, we don't want to go back to school, it's terrible. But I think they are missing it, actually. You know, the schools that they're at are doing a great job with remote work and remote learning for them. And I think that's worked in our case really well. But it's not the same as face-to-face. It's not the same as seeing your friends all the time. And I think whether they'll admit it or not, they will be grateful to be able to get back whenever that happens.
Okay, but one question you may have forgotten rather than dodged it, Steve, is about the Conservatives. Why the Conservatives rather than another party?
I wasn't a born and bred Tory. It's not something I grew up with. I gradually got more interested in politics through my 20s and 30s, and I just found myself agreeing with the Conservative Party more than I agreed with any other. I think, fundamentally, being a Conservative is about freedom. It's about personal responsibility alongside it, and people being able to make their own choices about their own lives. And that's something that chimes with me.
I mean, one of the constant criticisms of the Conservatives, though, is this inequality this enormous gap between rich and poor, which is widening, and the ability of the rich to pretty much evade tax. It seems that is I'm afraid that's one of the main things about the Conservative Party. Many people, if you just ask them, what do the Tories do? Well, they say they just protect the rich and help them keep their money so they don't pay much tax.
Well, I you're right, that's what people say. Obviously, I dispute that. I think as far as inequality goes, we could have a long debate about whether inequality is the problem or whether poverty is the problem. And I think if you define the wrong problem, you end up with the wrong solutions. But as far as tax avoidance goes, every government that has ever come in of any party in any country has said it will crack down on tax avoidance, and yet it still exists. But if you look at the figures that the Inland Revenue HMRC produce, for the amount of tax, the share of tax paid by the richest, that has gone up consistently since we've had Conservative or Conservative-led governments since 2010. And the latest one that I saw the other day is that the richest or the highest earning 1% of people in this country now pay 30% of all income tax. So the idea that the rich get away without paying taxes under the Tories is a very pervasive one, but I don't think it's true.
Martin?
Well, I mean, as Steve says, it's a question of whether we're talking about inequality or poverty, and obviously there's a big difference. I think there's a general understanding in society at large that inequality is too high. I recognise that people in the Conservative Party recognise that, but I don't think ultimately that what I've seen in my lifetime, I'm 60 years old, is a massive increase in inequality. And of course, the reduction of the top rate of tax in this country in the 1950s was in 95%. In the US, it was 96%. And of course, it's not just income that's a problem, it's wealth inequality. And, of course, the top 1% are paying 30% of the taxes. That's because they've become massively wealthier because of the financialisation of the economy after the Big Bang in the 1980s.
But, Martin, can you just explain this term, financialisation?
Well, basically, the allocation of resources by stock markets has not been as pervasive in the past as it has become, as it has now become. For example, after the 1929 crash, the Dow Jones Index didn't return to where it had been in 1929 until 1953. So there were several decades in which the stock market went nowhere in particular. And, of course, what was happening in those decades was that the government was actually carrying out most investments, partly because of the New Deal policies in the US, but also because of the Second World War. And, of course, coming out of the Second World War, governments of all political stripes inherited a big public sector, which gave them a lot more levers to deal with problems like inequality. And we've now, of course, because of what's happened, the Chancellor of the Exchequer has, in fact, massively increased government debt and expenditure. That's in many ways the right thing to do, although, of course, in actual fact, they're pushing money towards individual private companies, and those individual private companies, if they're going to take money, like in Scotland, they've got to have no, they shouldn't be based in tax havens, they shouldn't be getting any money at all. And, of course, if we are going to bail things out, then we should own the things we bail out, which basically massively increases the public sector. So we could see out of this crisis a return to that consensus about a large public sector, which we used to have in the 1950s.
Okay, Steve, the obvious question here is, since the public is bailing out so much, rather like 2008, actually, right now, in fact, some would say more money is going to bailouts. What's the public sector? What are we, the public, the taxpayers, getting back in return?
Well, tax is the obvious answer. If you allow industry or businesses to fail, I remember most of the... what we're talking about is not billionaires sitting in tax havens hoovering up public money. It's small and medium businesses up and down the country who are employing people. And most of us in this country are employed by small businesses. If those businesses are allowed to go bust, then the public sector picks up the tab for that for a very long time. If those businesses can be protected and allowed to pick up again once this is over, whatever over looks like, then people carry on being employed and businesses carry on operating and paying tax, which we are going to need to pay off, as Martin said, all the massive amount of expenditure that has gone into managing this crisis.
Yeah, but I mean, it does seem...
You don't pay for that by letting businesses go bust.
It does seem as this whole idea of austerity seems to be out of the window for a while anyway. What do you make of what's been going on with Bristol Energy, though, Steve? Because this is a company that's had £38 million or so of our taxpayers' public money here in Bristol, and it hasn't delivered a dime in return.
No, it hasn't. And I think it's been clear for a long time that the company, I don't think it's ever made a profit, and its losses are getting bigger every year. I think the writing is on the wall for this business. I know a news story broke with Sky News, I think it was, a few weeks ago, that the council is looking to sell the business off and cut its losses. I wish I could tell you whether that was true or not, but I'm afraid Sky News would be given more information about this than we have as councillors. We've got an extraordinary council meeting taking place next Tuesday to debate this and try and push the executive, the council administration, to be more open with the public and with us about what they're doing. But most of that meeting has to take place in closed session because we are not permitted to tell the people that we represent what little we do know about this business and what's going on with it. And even when we do that in closed session, as we understand it, there is further information that the council administration has, the leadership, the mayor and the cabinet, that hasn't been given to us as councillors. So even when we're debating this behind closed doors, we still don't have all the information and don't know fully what's going on.
So this is our money. I mean, part of your job, Steve, is to make sure that the mayor is spending it wisely, but apparently you're not allowed to do that.
No, we're not. There have been... most of what's gone on with Bristol Energy has gone on behind closed doors. a very small number of councillors have been allowed to observe, not take part, but observe the various meetings that take place within the slightly complicated structure of shareholding that the council has. Those councillors that have been allowed to observe it aren't allowed to share with anybody else what they've seen and heard. And as I said, the confidential reports that have been received, there are some confidential reports that I and other councillors have seen. And if it sounds like I'm pausing here, I'm trying to tread very carefully and not break the law by saying something I shouldn't say. But as we understand it, there are further confidential reports with more information that it appears Sky News have seen, but councillors haven't.
Well, this is the way that corporate big business like oil companies run things. It's not the sort of thing you would expect from Bristol City Council, you know, leaking stuff to Sky before councillors are allowed to hear it. And it does bring to mind a report from a couple of weeks ago in the Bristol Post. Elected mayor in Bristol, it says, harder to hold to account, researchers are finding. There is an over-concentration of power in the hands of a single leader. And this is Amanda Cameron reporting in the Bristol Post. What do you make of that, Steve? Because what they're saying here, effectively, is that a survey that's been done by Bristol University and by the University of the West of England is saying some nice things about the elected mayor, now Marvin Rees, for Labour. It's boosted the visibility of leadership, but it's harder to hold the role to account, including to the research. In fact, there's a quite considerable drop in just basic levels of trust around the city in the city council. Mirror, this whole idea of having an elected mayor was originally backed by the Conservatives, wasn't it?
It was, and we got it wrong. I think we've recognised that as a group on the council. Our policy, had we had a local election in May, which obviously wasn't postponed, it's going to happen next year, would have been that we think we should hold the next referendum to which we're entitled in 2023, I think it is, to put back to the people of Bristol whether they want to continue having a mayor or go back to a leader in cabinet type position that we had before, where at least the people leading the council are accountable to other councillors and can be challenged and can be removed if they're not doing the job. Whereas at the moment, the mayor, once he's been elected, is there for 4 years, or five as it turns out, and cannot be held to account.
Well, also in the city this week, New Labour, it says here, I don't know if it's actually a party calling itself or nicknamed New Labour, but anyway, it's a purge against Israel critics this week. Asa Wynne-Stanley writing in Electronic Intifada, the UK Labour Party's launched a new purge of the left, he says, and the Palestine Solidarity Movement still remaining in its ranks. A noted academic on the Israel lobby and two leading members of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign branch are among those whose party memberships was suspended on Monday this week. Professor David Miller of Bristol University, as well as Becky Massey and Pam Page of Brighton Palestine Solidarity Campaign, all Labour Party members. Well, they are no more. They're all been suspended. In fact, Martin, we had David Miller several times on our programme, mostly really talking about the way that the Israel lobby is being very successful in propaganda purposes. In other words, stifling critics of Israel.
Well, I mean, his suspension from the Labour Party suggests that he's bang on the money there, doesn't he? I'm afraid this conflict is going to continue because the pro-Palestinian faction in the Labour Party is predominant, in fact, and the pro-Israeli faction, which is what it is, basically controls some of the party apparatus. So there's going to be a continuing row about this. I think basically it's a row that's got to be had. The Israelis are basically in defiance of the UN resolutions going back 30 years. They're about to unilaterally annex large chunks of the West Bank. When Serbia tried to do that in the 1990s, when I was an aid worker in Bosnia, we went to war with them and killed 10,000 civilians to make sure that they couldn't have Kosovo. But the Israelis are about to carry out very similar actions with no consequences whatsoever. And anybody who says that they're doing the wrong thing is then being targeted by the Labour Party machinery. Now, ultimately, of course, we control the Labour Party and the machinery will do what we want it to do. And I think Keir Starmer has got to actually be seen to be acting independently here. They've got Jewish members of the party who've been active for many, many years are being victimised in this witch hunt. And there's going to be pushback.
Well, it doesn't seem that there is, Martin. Looking at what's happening this week, it's the Israel lobby seems to have the whip hand. A sociologist, David Miller, is an expert on the propaganda operations of state and corporate lobbies. He also, by the way, I came across him years ago as a journalist, running a very, very useful website called Spinwatch, which was looking at the vested interests of many of the so-called independent experts we see on our TV screens and hear on the radio and see in the newspapers. Really, really brilliant and useful site, so you can see who's paying the piper. So anyway, he says he's documented the methods and history of the pro-Israel lobby for many years. This latest round of suspensions continues the targeted harassment of what he calls socialist members. A book Miller co-wrote about the Labour Party was censored during the party's conference last year after Israel lobby pressure under the guise of Labour's anti-Semitism crisis. The party throughout outgoing pro-Corbyn general election, he argued that the suspensions were designed to target members who understand the racism of Zionism. Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I basically largely agree with David Miller. He's a very eminent researcher.
But is he right? Is Zionism racist?
Well, you've got to recognise that Zionism is a political ideology. It's a political ideology that believes that Israel has a right to the Holy Land, as we used to call it. And of course, if they were willing to accept what they were given in 1948, then there wouldn't be an argument. But there isn't. And since 1948, they've continuously been engaged in aggrandizing and annexing Palestinian land. And as I said, in the 1990s, we went to war with Serbia for far less. And I mean war. And then, but not sanctions, not slaps on the wrist. The RAF were bombing, and we killed a lot of people, but they didn't get Kosovo. And of course, Kosovo is now a mess, and Bosnia is still a mess, and lots of places where wars have been raging are now still in total chaos as a result of Western intervention. So in actual fact, that wasn't necessarily all a brilliant idea. But the fact is that the Israeli government of the day didn't support NATO intervention in Yugoslavia because they recognised immediately that that was setting a precedent.
Steve, that this is a Labour Party squabble going on here. But what do you make of the power of the Israel lobby in this country? I think it's probably true to say it's quite powerful in the Conservative Party too.
Well, I've always been slightly confused about why factions within UK political parties, and it is mainly the Labour Party that divides itself in this way. We find other things to divide ourselves over in the Tory Party. But why a UK political party would want to divide itself into factions based on taking sides in a long-running, horrific, intractable conflict in another continent? And I don't mean to diminish the importance of that conflict in any way, but it seems an odd thing to be the top priority for a UK political party whose raison d'etre is supposed to be representing working people in the UK.
Moving on to look at the pandemic, the COVID virus, Luke Johnson, we're going to have a listen now to. He's a former Channel 4 director, and he was once the Pizza Express chairman. He was on last week's BBC Question Time. So let's hear what he's got to say about COVID-19 now.
How many people who have no other morbidities under the age of 60 have died from this illness?
Who have no other morbidities?
Yeah.
Because I can tell you how many people under 65 have died. And obviously under some of those 60, with other morbidities,
no other morbidities
may well have survived. A morbidity doesn't mean you're...
350. You're more likely to drown. There's 400 people a year that drown, right? So I think we have to get things a bit in context.
What comfort would that offer to the families of those who've lost
Every death is tragic, but believe me, we are entering, we're already in, the largest recession for 300 years. In fact, it's not just one recession. The Bank of England have said the economy will shrink by 14%. That's the equivalent of two recessions. It's a depression. And I wouldn't be surprised if we have 2 million more unemployed people within a year. Imagine the agony of 2 million more unemployed people. How many deaths might flow from that? How many deaths are flowing from the fact that we've got half as many A&E appointments at the moment? Cancer patients not being seen, people with heart disease not being seen. And the collateral damage of this campaign of fear and lockdown has to be taken into account. Very soon, I believe, lockdown will be causing more deaths than the virus.
So that was Luke Johnson. He's a former director of Channel 4 and of the Pizza Express restaurant chain. Steve, I think we should probably hear from you first on this, because there are a lot of people who are saying, well, both sides really, one, that we are beginning to open up the lockdown too quickly, and others are saying, actually, the cure seems to be worse than the disease.
Yeah, and there is no easy answer here, and any government of any party is going to come in for criticism at a time like this. I personally would tend to, I don't think I'd agree 100% with the speaker there, but certainly with the gist of what he's saying. I think the lockdown was the right thing to do at the time. I think it was necessary, and if you look at the graphs of death rates and hospital admissions and all the indicators of the virus, you see them tip and go down from the moment the lockdown started, and it was necessary to do that. But it comes at a cost. And I think the speaker there on question time was right, that we soon reach a tipping point where the cost of lockdown and the risk of continuing to keep business closed and people at home and schools closed becomes greater than the risk of the virus itself. And I think the government is recognising that and is starting to take steps out of this. It's not going to be easy, but we do need to reopen the country and get back to normal life as soon as we can do it. There isn't a zero-risk option here.
Martin Summers from the Labour Party. Well, you're not from the Labour Party, but you're a Labour Party member.
I'm a member.
Martin, can you give us your thoughts on what's being said there? I mean, he's really saying that the turning point is we've come there now where the lockdown is actually being more destructive to society and possibly even beginning soon to kill more people than the virus itself.
Well, I think the thing that what you've got to recognise is that we were going to have a recession anyway. The Federal Reserve started intervening in the repo market in the United States, in other words, basically printing money, in September, before coronavirus was widely understood to be around. In other words, we were probably going to have a crash anyway. And in actual fact, what's happened with the coronavirus is the massive increase of intervention by governments in the market has been covered by coronavirus. Everybody thinks, oh, they were intervening because of coronavirus. They were intervening because it was going down the drain anyway. And that's the problem that we face. Even if we reduce the lockdown, which, of course, there's all sorts of medical reasons why we might not want to do that, even if we did, there's no guarantee that the demand is out there in the world economy to reflate things. And that's the problem. The financial services sector has carried on since 2008, doing all the things they did before 2008, but on steroids because of the moral hazard of being bailed out the first time. And, of course, that's what we should have been arguing about for the last 10 years. What are we going to do with financial crisis too? But instead, we've wasted a lot of time talking about all sorts of other rather extraneous
matters.
It would
be quite useful and interesting to go and have a listen now to Fox News, Tucker Carlson, looking at the Los Angeles. The whole situation there is a very, very hard lockdown, which is still in force. And apparently the mayor, who usually there is an attempt to remove the mayor sometimes in the American system where enough citizens can get a petition together. Apparently they can't do that anymore, even though there are enough citizens in Los Angeles to get the mayor removed. The lockdown is preventing that. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Tucker Carlson giving us an idea of what's been going on in the United States, because many different places in the states have got different degrees of lockdown. Let's go to Los Angeles and have a look at them.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti has now extended the lockdown through the end of July. That means at least 2.5 more months of it. He's using law enforcement liberally to make certain that his citizens obey his orders. Police say they brought criminal charges against at least 60, quote, non-essential businesses for the crime of going to work. Countless other businesses have shut forever. They're not coming back. The citizens who remain stuck in Los Angeles are effectively hostages of the mayor. Garcetti has demanded that anyone who goes outside for any reason, as the heat rises in L.A., must wear a mask. It goes without saying there is no science to back up this order or any of Garcetti's so-called health decisions. In fact, it's possible that requiring masks outside will not prevent a single person from being infected in Los Angeles. But Garcetti doesn't care. Anyone who disobeys this order will be punished. It's nuts. But it's just the beginning of Eric Garcetti's thoroughly bizarre restrictions. The more you know, the weirder it is. Watch, for example, as Garcetti explains that anyone who goes to the beach must make certain not to touch dry sand. Wet sand is fine. Dry sand is now illegal.
Beaches will open up this week for exercise and active recreation only. In the wet sand, I guess, is a good way of thinking about it, not hanging out and tanning in the dry sand.
What's the science behind this? Once again, of course, there is none. None. This isn't reasoned, thoughtful policymaking. It's the expression of an autocrat who decided he must look tough by doing something or he won't get elected president, which has always been Eric Garcetti's primary goal. It's scary if you think about what this means. It means that America's second largest city has fallen under the total control of a neurotic megalomaniac who is terrified of dry sand. Eric Garcetti's personal phobias are now law in Los Angeles. Makes you think of the final days of Nicolae Ceaușescu in Romania, ranting at his subjects from the podium, imposing his strange obsessions on a helpless population. It would not be surprising to learn that Eric Garcetti is a compulsive hand washer with a very strange personal life. Guys like this are always the same once you scratch the surface. So how long will Los Angeles have to live like this? Possibly forever, Garcetti announced this week.
We've never been fully closed. We'll never be completely open until we have a cure. But I do believe that we can take steps, but monitor those numbers, listen to the scientists and the medical professionals, and make the tough calls, even when there's criticism.
Yeah, this can't go on. It's too crazy. Now, you may mock Los Angeles, and in some cases, it's deserved. There are some flaky people who live there. Barbara Streisand's in Malibu. But there are also an awful lot of normal, decent people in Los Angeles, millions of them. And some of them understand where Eric Garcetti is taking them and their city, and they've had enough. A couple of days ago, a group of them came together. It's totally bipartisan. Some of them are well-known liberal Democrats. Some are conservative Republicans and have been all their lives. Others are labor leaders, middle-class voters. The one thing they all have in common is the dead certain knowledge that Mayor Eric Garcetti is poison. He's hurting their city. He's hurting their families. Garcetti has allowed tens of thousands of mentally ill drug addicts to live on Los Angeles sidewalks and under overpasses. If you've been there recently, you know. He's also tolerated flagrant corruption in his own administration. Now he shut the entire city down simply because he feels like it. This group of citizens is going to try and bounce Eric Garcetti from the mayor's office. And they can. Under California law, politicians can be recalled by voters. You remember that Californians did it to their governor, Gray Davis, 17 years ago. It worked. Now, a recall petition in California requires 330,000 signatures. And that, unfortunately, is where Eric Garcetti has the advantage. Thanks to Garcetti's extended shelter-in-place orders, citizens are not allowed to gather these signatures. So under the guise of public health, Garcetti has stopped his political opponents from opposing him. And he's not the only one. You've seen this happen in many states, Michigan, New Jersey, others. Politicians around the country are doing this. As long as there is no vaccine for the Wuhan coronavirus, they can remain in power unchallenged forever.
So that's Tucker Carlson, and that was a report on Fox News, extremely biased report. But Martin Summers, you know, the point there, really important point he's making, amongst all the bias and the rhetoric, is that this is effectively a kind of middle class protest, people that you wouldn't normally expect to be out protesting because they can't do the recall petition, which they want to do.
Well, I mean, obviously that's the specific features to do with Los Angeles and the rules in Los Angeles. But as Tucker Carlson is, as you know, quite a partisan figure, but as he pointed out, he said at the very beginning of his report that the guy who's the LA mayor is doing this because he wants to be re-elected. Now, that suggests that a large proportion of the population of LA want lockdown. In actual fact, the problem in the United States is that they didn't control what was happening at the beginning of this crisis, and so they're way, way worse than many other countries, and now they're going to have a much longer lockdown as a result. Kerala in southern India are in a position to unlock down now, because they locked down solidly at the get-go, and they got on top of the problem.
Steve,
that hasn't happened in the US.
I wonder if you think that maybe the Conservatives' policy over the last... 12 years or so of sort of reducing government means that the government simply don't have the resources to deal with a pandemic like this. Basically, from reining back, you're basically relying on the private sector to do this stuff, because you don't have the resources in the public sector to do things like basic stuff like testing.
Well, I think that's true of almost every country. There was, I'm not sure there was anywhere that had the capacity to do, where are we now, getting on for 200,000 tests a day, and it will need to go up from there to many hundreds of thousands per day for a disease that didn't exist 6 months ago. I'm not sure you can blame the Conservatives for that. Now, other countries, people point to, I think, is it Singapore that's done the test and trace, test track and trace right from the start of this, and people blame the government here for not having that infrastructure there. But I think if back in January or February, a Conservative government had said to everybody, right, you've all got to install this app on your phone so we can track you all, there'd have been uproar. You know, people would be on this show saying how appalling it is that the government wants to be in everybody's phone. And I don't think that's got anything to do with austerity or the government cutting back the state. It's that we as a country weren't in a place, and I'm still not convinced we were in a place, where people are willing to accept that level of intrusion into their lives.
What about Rolls-Royce? We've heard this week 9,000 jobs to go. This is one of the major employers in Bristol. I mean, they'll be able to service the few existing Rolls-Royce engines out there, but basically that's it. It looks like the production line is grinding to a halt for possibly years to come.
Yeah, it does, and it's horrible. I don't know if we've seen exactly where those job cuts are going to fall, but of course people in Bristol are going to be really, really worried about it. And I suspect, sadly, it's not going to be the last announcement like that we see.
Well, hang on. Greta Thunberg was in Bristol back in end of February, wasn't she? Calling for this, effectively, the end of the airlines and the airliners.
She was, and it looks like she's got her wish, doesn't it? And I think what we're seeing now explains why not everybody agreed with Greta and her followers at the time, that trying to clean up the air and clean up the atmosphere by destroying the economy isn't necessarily the right way to go, and it has huge effects in the longer term that will impact on thousands of us. And in fact, I was in a briefing earlier this week with our Director of Public Health here in Bristol, who described the indirect effects of this situation, exactly this kind of thing, the loss of jobs, the loss of social contact, the effect of the lockdown, as a second health emergency. And I it does worry me that the cure could be as bad as the disease.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it's interesting, because we're hearing about cures. We heard this week, first of all, when there was discussion about children going back to school, there was a whole day and a half's worth, or 2 days' worth of news stories about this something called Kawasaki syndrome, who the news rather parsimoniously on all channels was saying could be linked to COVID-19. Well, I can tell you from the research I've done, it's definitely not linked to COVID-19. It's something which is a result, can be a result, and it has been in the past shown to be a result of a bad reaction to vaccines in the past. And so that's very disingenuous to say that these suffering children are suffering from something related to the pandemic, when actually it's a vaccine that's caused this. And also the other thing is relating to this is the antibody test. I think hydroxychloroquine, which Trump was criticised for taking. Well, I see a report from the New York University Grossman School of Medicine, which looked at nearly 1,000 coronavirus patients. Apparently, this drug increased those patients' chances of being discharged, and cut death rates by almost 50%. So that's why Trump is taking this, because it is actually being used successfully to treat people who already got it. No, it won't prevent you getting it, but if you do get it, your body will be able to fight it much more easily with this stuff inside you. So we seem to be seeing quite a lot of literally fake news and disinformation about the virus too. We'll be talking about that more in the second hour. But one thing we cannot really argue about is the way that foreign carers have been told they've got to pay the NHS surcharge, and there's been a U-turn on that this week after Keir Starmer brought it up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Speaker, every Thursday we go out and clap for our carers. Many of them are risking their lives for the sakes of all of us. Does the Prime Minister think that it's right that care workers coming from abroad and working on our front line should have to pay a surcharge of hundreds, sometimes thousands of pounds, to use the NHS themselves?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I thought a great deal about this, and I do accept and I do understand the difficulties faced by our amazing NHS staff, and like him, I've been a personal beneficiary of people who've come from, carers who've come from abroad and frankly saved my life. So I know exactly the importance of what he says. But on the other hand, we must look at the realities that this is a great national service. It's a national institution. It needs funding, and those contributions actually help us to raise about £900 million. And it's very easy, very difficult in the current circumstances to find alternative sources. So with great respect to the point that he makes, I do think that that is the right way forward.
So that's Boris Johnson replying there on the question of the NHS surcharge. Good to see, Martin, isn't it, that that's now, almost immediate. I think it's yesterday. The day, within 24 hours, the surcharge has been lifted and now foreign care workers don't have to pay it anymore.
Well, I mean, it just shows political cack-handedness, doesn't it, really? At one stage, we're being told to go out and clap all these heroes, and the next minute, we're picking their pockets. But I think also that then he says there's 900 million comes from this source. We've just printed massively more than that to bail out all sorts of things. So the whole argument that there's no money and no magic money tree has shown to be rubbish. There's a whole forest of magic money trees. That's the Federal Reserve in the United States.
Steve?
Yeah. Very, very quick U-turn. And it was driven, I think, largely by backbench Conservative MPs coming out on Twitter on Wednesday afternoon and Thursday morning, saying that they disagree with the government, that they got it wrong on this and needed to change. And I agree, actually. I think the idea that people who are coming to this country, particularly right now in the middle of this crisis and saving not just Boris Johnson's life, but thousands and thousands of people's lives, should then have to pay to use the service that they work in, it is wrong, and I'm glad it's been changed. But important as it is for those people right now, I think it's part of a bigger conversation that we're now starting to have about immigration and how we manage the system and how we pay for that. So, for example, is it right that now a nurse coming to this country doesn't have to pay that surcharge, but someone coming to this country to pick fruit in our field still does? I don't know. But it's part of a bigger discussion that's now starting, and I'm glad that it is.
Another medical story this week, before we go, we'll go back to COVID, I think, before the end of the programme again, but it's to do with organ donation, and we've seen it passed into law. Effectively, what there is an opt-in rather than an opt-out from organ donation. So the assumption will be by medical professionals that if you die in an accident or whatever, and your organs are useful for transplant, they can take them. You know, if there's any kind of doubt about whether you wanted them to or not, up until now, Steve, you'd had to say, keep an organ donor card or register with the NHS to say, yes, I'm happy for you to take my organs. Now, we don't have to do that anymore. Those organs could go without you actually being asked. I mean, this is a big change, isn't it? The onus is on them to decide what they want to do rather than you now with your organs.
It is, yeah, and it's not an easy decision. There's all sorts of difficulties on both sides. But for me, I think this is the right way to go. I think when you look at the data from other countries that have done this, in terms of the effect that it makes on the availability of organs for people who desperately need them. For me, that outweighs the downside of the issues around the presumed consent. So it is difficult that it's happened right now when there's nothing in the news except COVID. At a normal time, this would have been headline news for a long time and a lot more people would have been aware of it than they are now. But it has been failed.
There is another issue, Martin. There's another issue which really hasn't been brought out at all this week in the discussion, and that is that actually there is quite an enormous international trade in organs, and that there are all sorts of unscrupulous criminals who will trade people's organs around the world for vast sums of money.
Well, that's right. That's the privatised mayhem if you don't have a national health service to protect you. I agree with Steve. I think basically it's a good idea. It's one of personal solidarity with other people. I know, and if people really want to object, I'm sure Jehovah's Witnesses and others will want to object. They can opt out, and they will be allowed to opt out.
Well, religious Jews will get a lockout. The chief rabbi has welcomed new provisions for Jewish organ donors in addition to the Organ Donation Act, which changes the system from opt-in to opt-out in England. So, but it means that halachic considerations will be taken into account and all Jewish families will be consulted. So there are some opt-outs in this for religious views. Is that the right thing to do?
If you for religious reasons do not want your organs to be used in this way, then it's perfectly straightforward. You opt out. But I think for everybody else, if they think about it, I mean, personally, if I was involved in a car accident and one of my organs could help some young person with liver problems or whatever, I don't suppose that would be a good one to choose from my point of view. But these are, you know, it seems to me that that's part of
being part of society,
isn't it?
You can carry an organ donor card, Martin. Jolly.
Well, I could, but the onus is on me to go out and do that. And I might, of course, I might be motivated to do that. But frankly, I'd rather have the government decide for me, and because that saves me bothering. And then, therefore, I can just get on with my life, knowing that that's all sorted, and I don't have to worry about it.
Righto. So we're going to look at another aspect of the coronavirus, the lockdown, actually, not the virus particularly, but the reaction to it, which is the doubling of unemployment of under 24s. And this was brought up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Lucy Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Unemployment in the under 24 age group has already doubled in Telford compared to this time last year, and it's clear that the aftermath of the pandemic will hit our young people hardest, with disruption to education and training as well as job losses. I know that my right honourable friend is passionate about opportunities for young people, particularly in areas such as Telford, which have suffered disproportionately in previous recessions. Will he ensure that the recovery strategy focuses on young people and equipping them with the skills they need to survive in a post-pandemic economy and indeed thrive in the longer term?
Prime Minister.
She's absolutely right to speak up for the young people of Telford and their immense potential, and that's why we'll be supporting her and them with a new national skills fund worth £2.5 billion, so that young people can be at the very forefront of our effort to come out of this this epidemic.
Okay, great. A national skills fund, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee you a job, Steve, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think, as I was saying before when we talked about Rolls-Royce, unfortunately, we're going to see more bad news on the economy and on jobs than before we start seeing good news again. I think there'll be some sectors that bounce back quite quickly. And, you know, where jobs have been furloughed and protected, hopefully people will be able to get back to work and pick up where they left off.
But with the millions of unemployed people now, particularly with young people, I mean, surely we need to mobilise those people in some way, whether it's some sort of, work camp, which is paid, where you get paid, some sort of state provision to do something. I mean, this is what, for example, Roosevelt did in the United States in the Great Depression in the 30s, was he said, well, actually, the government needs to intervene to make sure that these people are not sitting around doing nothing, just claiming benefits, because it's not good for them and it's not good for the country.
Yeah, I'm not sure about government-run work camps. not convinced that's a particularly efficient or effective way of
solving. I'm being a bit provocative saying that.
I know you are.
Something needs to be done to give young people something to do.
Yes, I agree. And what I would love to see is the government intervening, not to directly employ everybody who's unemployed and create work camps, but to stimulate the economy in the right places where it can. And you know, this £2.5 billion training fund, it is part of that, and investment into infrastructure and all the stuff that the government was talking about before coronavirus hit is part of that as well. But then I think that, and I hope we will start to see pretty quickly a lot more than that in the government using its, not just its money actually, but using its influence in a smart way and in a targeted way to stimulate the economy and to support businesses and support all of us to go out and start living our lives as normally as we can again. Because if we can start doing that, if we can go out and we can spend money, those of us who are able to do that, that's what gets people back to work and gets things moving.
Martin, I wonder what you make. I mean, okay, I'm being provocative saying work camps. This is the sort of thing that was done, you know, in the Depression back in the 1930s, even in places like New Zealand. You know, they had such massive numbers of unemployed people, and apparently the food wasn't very good. You know, but something surely needs to be done by the government to actually literally employ people. It's very, very bad to have, you know, half our under-24s without a job to go to.
Well, I think what's beginning to happen is the consensus is moving back to the idea that the government is ultimately responsible for ensuring that everybody is given some kind of work or some kind of training. They're not just allowed to fall through the cracks.
No, well, and also, I mean, the infrastructure can be, I mean, maybe people working on infrastructure.
Well, indeed. But what's significant about this? And I think it's important that what may be happening is we're moving back to a more Keynesian era where the Conservative Party is starting to jettison the Thatcher ideology that you can't intervene and you've just got to leave it to the market. That is actually to be welcomed because I think we need to develop a consensus around this. The real problem, I'm afraid, is that because we're going to have a big shock now, that shock will be transmitted to the financial markets where the derivatives market is still completely overbought. The stock market is at completely ridiculous levels in both the US and Britain. And there will then be a financial crisis after they've been bailed out. So all the money that we bail them out with will then be lost.
It does sound as if, you know, quite a lot of finance, the City of London and our politics with our mayor is almost like becoming detached from reality. But anyway, the Varoufakis, Yanis Varoufakis from Greece was on the BBC earlier this week talking about whether or not it was going to be time for austerity. And he begins by talking to the BBC's Emma Barnett from the Manchester crime family, by the way. Emma Barnett is the daughter of a convicted brothel runner in Manchester who was put on to replace Victoria Derbyshire on the BBC, which seems a bit strange. But anyway, here's Emma Barnett speaking to Yanis Varoufakis to begin with about the situation in Greece.
The greatest problem we have is what you mentioned, that after 10 years of a Great Depression, not just a recession, we are going to have very few victims from coronavirus, which is a fantastic thing, but we're going to have the largest proportion of people who go hungrier every night to bed.
When you look at the UK, a country you know well, do you think that it's inevitable that we go back to austerity?
Absolutely not. Take this very silly idea out of your collective minds. The one good thing about this government is that you have a Chancellor of the Exchequer who doesn't believe this nonsense. There are people in the Treasury that are pushing him in the direction of austerity. The austerity would be absolutely catastrophic. It would be a major act of self-harm for the United Kingdom. What you're facing is a simultaneous collapse of demand and supply. It is right that the public debt should rise. You should not worry about public debt. Think of it, even if you are worried about public debt, medium-term increase in public debt is an investment into reducing all sorts of debts in the future. Because unless the government steps in to refloat the economy, then you're going to end up with many, many more bankruptcies, and then public debt will be a problem as well as private debt in the future, because the economy will not be producing in 2-3 years' time the taxes and the incomes that it can produce if the government steps in now and, you know, just ignores the silence of austerity.
So when you say refloat, what do you mean by that?
Well, public investment. The government needs to invest massively. You have the great asset of the Bank of England, which we don't have in the Eurozone. We don't have a central bank that can come to the aid of public investment. Already the Bank of England is spending money to purchase treasury bills and, you know, just, yeah, treasury bonds. You should do a lot more of that, as long as the money is well spent, as long as the money is spent on modernizing Britain, on shifting to the new green technology that will be the future. Britain, I've already seen that there are moves to establish the production of batteries, which is going to be the future for car production, for all sorts of other renewable technologies. It is an excellent opportunity to invest in the things that you should be investing in any case in Britain. Boris Johnson has already, even before coronavirus, advocated, especially having won many Labour seats in the north of England, the importance of investment. This is not the time for austerity.
Well, that's Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek MP still. And I wonder what you make, Steve, of his... He's saying basically, look, austerity would be crazy right now.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think the situation we're in now is different from what it was in 2010. Endless borrowing and printing money, what the Bank of England is doing at the moment, you talked about there, buying bonds. Martin referred to it earlier as a magic money tree. And you know, maybe it is, but it's not free money. It does come at a cost, whether that cost is increased debt or whether it's inflation with the bank's expansionary stuff. So we need to be careful with it, but I don't think that's our biggest problem right now. And I think we're in a much better position now than we were in 2010 in terms of the world market's willingness and ability to lend, that enables the government to invest and to stimulate the economy.
But Steve, last week we were talking about Thangam Debonair, who's the shadow housing minister now. She was saying, talking about rent holidays, that this is a good thing. But the thing is, a rent holiday doesn't mean to say you don't have to pay the rent at all. It just means that you're putting it off into the future. Isn't that effectively what the government's doing with the idea of, you know, borrowing money and paying it back down the road somewhere? Because once the lockdown is finished, we could be many, many people could be simply massively more in debt and facing eviction.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying, that this magic, you know, whether you get this magic money tree from borrowing or whether you get it from printing money, neither of those things is free, and they do come at a cost. Right now, unlike 2010, I think that is a cost that we can bear, and it's one that's worth paying to get the economy up and running.
Martin?
Well, I think that I agree with Steve about what we should do now. It possibly won't be enough. That's part of the problem. But in 2010, don't forget, we lost our AAA credit rating because the economy was starting to fail because of too much austerity. That was absolutely incompetent by the Conservative Liberal coalition.
Borrowing money because we lost our credit rating.
We lost our credit rating because we'd had too much austerity. And in actual fact, austerity was a political choice, just as it's a political choice not to do it now. But let's concentrate on the positive. If we move together as a society to a more consensual view of the role of government in the economy, which is going to be much expanded as it was in the 1940s, and there's no reason why that can't be a Conservative policy as well as a Labour policy. That's what made those policies so so solid, because it didn't matter who the government was. They were not going to cut public expenditure in a recession, which is what we learned in the 1930s, supposedly, except that we decided to forget it in the 1980s.
Steve, what do you make of the, and we've only got a minute to go, but what do you make quickly of the European Union saying that, well, it makes no sense to have a deadline at the end of this year. We're going to have to extend it, the trade talks.
personally, I'd like to see it get done by the end of the year. I think if it's not going to get done this year, there's no reason to think it'll get done the next year or the year after either. Deadlines stimulate action. It worked this time around in terms of the deadline to leave the EU. If you just keep extending it, nothing will ever get done.
Martin?
Well, I think it's perfectly reasonable to suggest that we should extend the transition period given what's happened. But it's not going to happen. I'm sure Steve is going to get his will. There's going to be a toughest of hardest Brexits at the end of the year. And that, of course, may probably undo all of the positivity of investment that may come from the other.
Well, thanks to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henlees, Steve Smith. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look with Martin Summers around the world. So that was Polystyrene and the song about the germ-free adolescence song from the 1970s. But welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The fuse is lit for World War III in Hong Kong as China decides to impose strict rules against public gatherings once the pandemic is over. So this is from Beijing now. The new national security laws being enacted at this weekend's Chinese Communist Party's Congress means criticism of President Xi as well as failure to respect the flag or national anthem will be a crime, as will be any discussion of extending democracy or independence for Hong Kong. Many Hong Kongers are petrified, having seen surprise arrests of many of their pro-democracy leaders during the lockdown. Unprecedented censorship, too, by YouTube this week, and social media have expert views on the lockdown. These have been ignored, those views, and the censorship, of course, by the mass media. And we hear from two of them tonight, Dr. Knut Witkowski and Dolores Cahill, both pandemic experts, arguing against the hard lockdown that we've seen in the West. It does seem clear the mass media is complicit in trying to extend the lockdown as much as possible by stifling expert views to the contrary. Also censored has been Max Egan's mind-blowing report with hard evidence that the March 2019 Christchurch mosque massacre was indeed a military operation rather than just a lone wolf. We hear from his report, which YouTube censored. The shooter's manifesto is banned in New Zealand, but there on the title page is the Nazi Black Sun. We hear from Portuguese artist and researcher Aerith Hager. What was the Black Sun and what is it today? Also, Bristol's atomic spy, Klaus Fuchs, who leaked the atomic bomb plans to Stalin's Russia in the 1940s. Plus, more incredible evidence that the Nazis got there first with the atom bomb. Classified documents only released 70 years after the war, according to Joseph Farrell. And his book, amazingly enough, also mentions the Black Sun. It's called The Reich of the Black Sun. And finally, tonight, the Zionists who we are not allowed to criticise. That is, links to Satanism and plans for a world government and world religion, allegedly anyway, with another censored person from YouTube. That's James Perloff. One always has to ask the question, I think, with this censorship, are these views dangerous? Are they criminal? Or are they just the views that YouTube don't like? Anyway, Martin, I think we should start really by looking at China particularly and this new legislation that's being brought in by the Chinese Communist Party this weekend.
Well, I mean, obviously tensions between China and the West are the highest that they've ever been really since the 1970s. And of course, the hardliners on both sides are banging the drums and the people of Hong Kong are in the middle. And of course, that's going to cause, it's a basic, one of the sources of friction between the superpowers.
But you think, don't you, that the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong is actually funded by the CIA, the Western intelligence services?
Well, I mean, some of them certainly are. There's no doubt about the fact that the West stirs up trouble in Hong Kong for the Chinese. They support those who oppose the Chinese government, and they give them publicity and various material support of various kinds. That doesn't mean that they don't have a case. It doesn't mean that the people of Hong Kong don't have their own views, but they're very much, you know, minnows in a fight between elephants.
These superpowers, I mean, what we're looking really seeing is Hong Kong as a kind of battleground for China and the West to have a little fight in Hong Kong. Now, obviously, the people there are extremely worried, aren't they?
Well, they're right to be worried because obviously that's going to create problems for them, isn't it? If there was not all the other things going on, you could perhaps see, possibilities of compromise developing. But given the fact that we've got a confrontational situation, I mean, frankly, the Chinese are preparing for war against the West. And the British are sending our ships into the South China Sea to provoke them. And they are preparing to fight us.
See,
and
it's interesting, isn't it?
That's the reality of the situation.
I'm reminded of the peace dividend. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, we were all told things were going to get better. You know, a lot of people seeing this pandemic happening were hoping, well, this is going to bring the world together. Actually, it seems to be being used as an excuse to actually ramp up tension between Washington and Beijing.
It is. And of course, fundamentally underlying this is the potential that this is not an accidental set of events. Trump and the Murdoch press in the West are definitely pushing the idea that the virus came from the laboratory in Wuhan, which incidentally does lots and lots of contracts for Western governments. So it would be quite easy for Western governments to infiltrate that laboratory and to basically kick all of this off.
I mean, Martin,
the hardliners in the Communist Party in China are pretty clear that they think this is an attack on China by the West.
Back in the end of January, beginning of February, when this first broke, the story of the virus in Wuhan, we were pointing out that actually it was Israeli-related sources, including the Alex Jones program, that were immediately pointing the finger at the Virology Institute in Wuhan without any real evidence. And we now know almost certainly that this virus was around long before that, both in Britain and the United States.
Well,
and
I mean,
France.
Well, I mean, the obviously future historians are going to comb over this. But it seems that it may have actually been around for quite a while before it appeared in Wuhan. But anyway, as you will know, there are a number of allegations going on around this. I don't think it's credible that the Chinese would have started this deliberately. It may have leaked from their laboratory, but if it did, it would be an accident. But of course, the Chinese also let it be known that they suspected the military games which were held in Wuhan.
Yeah, okay. But do you think Trump is going to be able to source for the outbreak? Chinese? Are the West going to successfully be able to pin it on the Chinese?
Well, politically, Trump is pushing in an open door in the US because they've been basically demonizing the Chinese for years. So it may work for him politically in the US. And of course, Biden, they're talking about him as being Beijing Biden. And of course, both major parties in the US are tempted to turn any popular anger that there may be about failures over coronavirus or the economy collapsing onto the Chinese. And the Chinese, of course, from their point of view, are mobilizing their people to say, well, look, you know, the West is the one that's not being reasonable here in all sorts of different ways. And don't forget,
mentioning Biden there. Phone calls between Biden and Ukraine's Poroshenko have been leaked. Details of $1 billion quid pro quo for Hunter Biden to fire the Burisma prosecutor. So this is not really been reported here, but this is incredible. $1 billion to this company and to Hunter Biden in order to get the state prosecutor in Ukraine sacked.
Well, I mean, that's what's been going. Basically, the coup in Ukraine. There's been a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police were acquitted because they were able to demonstrate, because they got people testifying on video from Georgia, that the snipers who killed 80 plus people in the Maidan Square were working, they were Georgians working for NATO. So NATO killed all of those people we saw at the start of the coup. And also there's a Dutch intelligence officer, one of the senior people in Dutch intelligence, who's also come out and said, well, the evidence is that there was no missile fired at a plane when MH17 was shot down, which of course means that the other explanation, which is by far the more likely one, it was shot down by a Ukrainian fighter plane. So most of the killing in Ukraine from the get-go has been orchestrated by NATO intelligence services, working of course with the Israelis and the British.
Okay.
So that's what's been going on.
Well, let's get back to Hong Kong and China because I think, you know, I really feel for people in Hong Kong. They seem to be almost like guinea pigs stuck in the middle, piggy in the middle here. And there was a report on Channel 4 News last night. I think it was by Matt Fry, looking at all the politics behind this. And also then they interviewed the former governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, who's also, of course, well, for those that may know, for many years he was BBC chairman. I mean, he's one of those establishment people that is very difficult to trust, but he was put in that very important position in Hong Kong.
China has proposed a sweeping national security bill for Hong Kong, which will ban acts of treason, sedition or subversion. A highly controversial measure will be introduced at the People's National Congress when it opens tomorrow in Beijing, and it's almost certain to spark fierce opposition in Hong Kong and abroad. Matt Fry reports.
Hong Kong has been one of the world's star performers in the COVID crisis, despite its proximity to mainland China. It ticked all the right boxes early on, from testing to masks to closing its borders. It took on board all the lessons of the SARS epidemic and has now only lost 4 lives to COVID. You might have thought that this model behaviour could earn it a gold star from its masters in Beijing. You'd be wrong. The Chinese government clearly sees COVID as an opportunity to impose some discipline on a restive stepchild. Tomorrow, the National People's Congress, the Communist Party's compliant parliament, will debate and then pass a national security law for Hong Kong. This is what the law intends to prevent, the kind of mass demonstrations that shook Asia's financial capital and rattled Beijing for much of last year. The law would ban all forms of sedition, subversion and secession, and could be used to end even the most peaceful demonstrations. Hong Kong's mini-constitution, underwritten by Britain, its former colonial masters, requires it to introduce, at some stage, a national security law. So far, it has failed to do so, because when it tried, it sparked the political unrest that culminated in the Umbrella Revolution. But ever since Lecce, the Hong Kong Assembly was defaced by pro-democracy demonstrators last summer, Beijing has been losing hope that the local legislature could pass the law. What's more, there are elections in September, which could result in gains for the pro-democracy parties. So Beijing has seized the opportunity to impose the law directly, thus trampling on the spirit, if not the letter, of the one country, two systems formula. This just a few weeks after the authorities rounded up some of the veterans of the democracy movement and charged them with unlawful assembly. Beijing thinks that COVID has given it a helping hand. Social distancing means that large gatherings are not just banned, but shunned for personal safety. And the eyes of the world may be distracted by the virus, but not the eyes of Donald Trump, who has turned blaming China into his re-election slogan, and who is almost certain to use the law to up the ante in what looks like his new Cold War with Beijing.
Well, I'm joined now from Southwest London by Lord Paton, who was the last British governor of Hong Kong. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has issued quite an attack on you after a recent speech you made, accusing you of sort of stirring up the protest movements, and is really critical of you. I mean, saying you're sort of meddling and will go down in history as sort of as just a historical notoriety.
Well, that's no change for me. I used to be described in that sort of way when I was governor of Hong Kong. Then when I was the European Commissioner for External Relations and responsible, among other things, for Chinese accession talks to the WTO, they decided I was a force for concord, not discord. The way the Chinese behave, and this regime in particular, is pretty predictable. If you say what they want you to say, you're a friend of China and they screw you. If you don't say what they want you to say, you're condemned for 1,000 generations. And occasionally, likely, you get remission. But what the hell? This is a frightened lot of bullies. And this is different from previous communist regimes since Mao. This has turned its back on what was happening under Jiang Zemin, Deng Xiaoping's view of one country, two systems. And why? Because they're frightened of delivering the promises that were given to people in Hong Kong. Matt was there during the demonstrations and did some terrific reporting. And he would have told you, I know, that the people who were out on the streets getting on for 2 million weren't terrible radicals. They were ordinary mums and dads. They were young and old, and they were working class and middle class, all who wanted Hong Kong to go on having the rule of law and the sort of freedoms that you associate with an open society. And one of my worries about what's happening is that this will be very damaging for the Hong Kong economy and for its position as an international hub in Asia. This will damage Hong Kong. And I do hope that they will have think again, and that any demonstrations will help them to think again. But I also hope that any demonstrations are peaceful and will avoid violence, whatever the provocation from the police.
So you support the idea of demonstrations over this? I mean, should the British government do anything? Should it raise it at least?
The British government should be the biggest demonstrator. The British government, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary should make it clear that this is a fundamental breach of the Joint Declaration, which is an international treaty lodged at the UN. They should raise it at the UN. They should raise it with all our friends and colleagues, with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, United States, European countries. It's an example, I'm afraid, of this very simple fact, which we're going to have to live with. You cannot trust Xi Jinping's China. That's different from previous administrations. He tightened up as a dictator. He cannot abide anybody who disagrees with him. And the Chinese government, not only in Hong Kong but elsewhere, are taking advantage of the fact that everybody's concentrating quite properly on fighting the coronavirus. They're taking advantage of that to throw their weight around to hector and to bully. And we must really learn to stand up to them.
Martin, Pompeo has been laying out the case for what he calls Cold War II. For several decades, he says, we thought the regime would become more like us through trade, scientific exchanges, diplomatic outreach. But that didn't happen. He's accused the World Health Organization's director, Tedros Adhanom, of unusually close ties to Beijing, started long before this current pandemic. So it doesn't look as if this is going away. It looks as if tensions between China and the US are just simply on a ratchet now.
Well, that's right. And of course, the people of Hong Kong were relations with China, apart from Hong Kong, on a more even keel, then the Hong Kong situation could be dealt with in a more considered fashion. But they are basically being used as pawns now. Trump is very much encouraging them to protest. And of course, what Trump would really like is for the People's Liberation Army to go into Hong Kong before November, and then he can say, look, we're going to war with China in every possible way you can think of. And of course, the Chinese military are presuming that they're going to have to do that anyway, which is why they're not that bothered about what people like Patton think. They think that they're already in a war with the US, and the time has come to actually start fighting properly. And of course, we are sending our ships to the South China Sea to object to what the Chinese are trying to do there. They would say, well, hang on a minute, you try and control the sea around Britain. That's what the Royal Navy's been there for hundreds of years. We're just trying to do the same thing here, and you can't just send your military vessels in our direction in the way that you are. And of course, the other thing that's going on is the Iranians are sending their tankers across to Venezuela, and that could turn into a shooting match
Some would say, Martin, that Chris Patton set this problem up in the first place with the deal he did with the Chinese.
Well, what he didn't mention, and what the Chinese would mention, is that when the British ran Hong Kong, there was no democracy, none whatsoever. Now, when the British have left, suddenly they're saying that there should be democracy in Hong Kong.
Yeah, but Martin, people weren't shot or arrested or imprisoned or whatever for laughing at the British flag.
No, they weren't. But at the same time, the idea that Britain, what the Chinese think from their point of view, I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm just saying the way they look at it. And don't forget, there's a hell of a lot more Chinese in China than there is in Hong Kong. You know, if there was a vote in the whole of China, they might vote to annex Hong Kong. Is that fair? I don't know.
What about the Chinese system, though? Because we've got almost like, he's like the Pope, isn't he, President Xi? The idea is you're not allowed to criticise him. If you say that he's wrong on something, you can be arrested for it.
Well, he's much more powerful than the Pope then, isn't he?
What I mean is the infallibility of it.
Well, the fact is,
it's almost Chinese, like a religion.
Well, it's the Chinese Communist Party has got an ideology called Chinese communism, socialism with Chinese characteristics. And their way of looking at the world and the way they organise themselves is rather different from the outside world. And that's been true forever. In actual fact, during the Maoist era, it was far, far more repressive than it is today. I mean, modern China is, relatively speaking, a modernized economy and society, high levels of education, and so on.
Okay, China came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where the question of China buying up dying British defense companies came up.
We're now going down to Dorset to Richard Drax. Richard Drax.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Defence Select Committee heard recently that France is conducting a root and branch review of its defence supply chain, following concerns that China is buying up defence-related companies that are going bust during this pandemic. Does my right honourable friend think it might be wise to consider doing the same thing here, in addition to rowing back from his plans to allow Huawei to roll out 5G?
Prime Minister.
I'm sure there's a legal term for the imputing of a policy to me that I've not yet announced by my honourable friend. What I will say is he's absolutely right to be concerned about investment, to be concerned about the buying up of UK technology now by countries that may not always may have ulterior motives, and we are certainly bringing forward measures to ensure that we protect our technological base, and I'm happy, and he'll be hearing a lot more about that in the next few weeks.
Well, it's a bit late, isn't it, really? I mean, almost all of our technology over the last 40 years, Martin, has already been bought up by foreign businesses and is being run for foreign shareholders.
Well, that's right. I mean, the philosophy of successive Conservative governments has been to let the market decide. And, of course, now they're deciding, oh, no, we're going to have some kind of strategic planning involved in this, but it's a bit late in the day. I mean, the Chinese, in fact, invest far more in Britain than they do in any other European country. And if we decide to go to war with them literally or just a Cold War, then that investment will dry up. And we're talking in the first hour about unemployment in the country and so on. If the Chinese decide to pack up and go elsewhere, that will be one of the implications.
Well, we're going to talk about censorship now, and our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko, sent me this rather shocking report about the censoring of Dolores Cahill, who's a pandemic expert in Ireland, and the way that a journalist from Business Insider actually flagged up the video to YouTube, who then took it down, and then he contacted the It Computing Forever, the website, the YouTube channel, saying, well, how do you feel about this being censored? I hope you're okay, that sort of thing. So let's have a listen now to the Computing Forever author, whoever he is, I'm not sure of his name, and the censorship of this actually very important interview with an expert in Ireland over the coronavirus.
I received an email from Martin Coulter of Business Insider that read, hey Dave, hope you're keeping safe and well under lockdown. Really? Do you really hope that I'm keeping safe and well under lockdown, Martin? Way to be all two-faced and nicey-nicey to me privately, and then publicly you admit that you flagged my video. I saw your video with Dolores Cahill was removed from Facebook and YouTube. I'll be covering this for Business Insider. Do you have any comment to offer with regards to the tech firm's actions? Please let me know when you can, and I'll be sure to include in our article, in your hit piece, you mean? In your hit piece against me and Dolores Cahill? Thank you, Martin, it says. I'm sorry, this is just absolutely unbelievable. Your tweet says, after we flagged it, suggesting you and or Business Insider flagged the video. Yeah, it was removed after it was flagged by you guys. So are you asking me if I have a comment to offer with regards to the tech firm's actions? Do you want me to give you a comment about how I feel about the fact that you guys actually are the ones who flagged my video? So you basically generated an article about the censoring of my video, which reads, Facebook and YouTube took 7 days to remove an hour-long video filled with COVID-19 conspiracies. Okay, you haven't bothered to address our claims or to see if what we're saying is true or not. You just fob them off as conspiracies, of course. And then when you click on this article, it immediately brings up a paywall. So you flagged my video, contacted me looking for a comment on the video's removal. You didn't tell me in your email that you guys were the ones who flagged it or that you were going to call me hard right, etc. You then proceeded to smear myself and Dolores on Twitter as hard right. You claim that the video contains conspiracies. You erroneously claimed that Dolores never mentioned that she was chair of the Irish Freedom Party, which she did. She said that in the video. You erroneously claimed that the video had 1 million views. It didn't. You then admitted that you guys flagged the video, and then you proceed to place this article of yours behind a paywall, essentially monetizing the censorship of my content. This is absolutely astounding. Totally shameless.
So, Martin, that's the guy that runs Computing Forever YouTube channel. I mean, it's almost like this is a story created by a journalist getting an interview with an expert on COVID-19 removed from the internet.
Well, I mean, I think this I haven't seen the video, so I don't know why.
We'll hear a bit from it in a minute.
Well, okay, but I mean, the point is that the real issue here is everything that we're talking about in relation to censorship. YouTube is a private company. And just like Rupert Murdoch, they go out and they can say whatever they want. Now, that's not really adequate as a way of protecting freedom of speech, because they're a monopoly. because of the way that the technology has developed.
Well, it's also the fact that they're looking for appetizers.
On Murdoch to do anything at all. He can lie, he can cheat. I mean, freedom of speech means freedom to lie. And of course, YouTube is basically exploiting that position that it has. They can decide that they don't like an opinion and they can get rid of it.
Martin, this is really about journalistic ethics. It's almost like the journalist that goes and sets fire to the warehouse in order to make a story about the warehouse being set on fire.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, it certainly raises questions on that front. It certainly does, no doubt about it.
Well, let's have a listen anyway to Professor Dolores Cahill in the YouTube video which was removed called Debunking the Narrative.
So I suppose what people should be aware of is that there are, first of all of our bodies, there are hundreds of thousands of different viruses in our bodies. And it's important that for our natural microbiome that we actually come in contact with bacteria and viruses. And so this just shows that every year, we'll say in the Northern Hemisphere, in the winter time, there is a flu season. And the CDC are just showing that this year, from we'll say week 48 in December of 2019 to the beginning of April or the middle of April, the 12th of April, there were three circulating viruses.
Hello, I can't talk now. I'm live on the radio.
The first one was influenza B. The second one was influenza A. And the third one was this COVID-19 virus. And that generally, you know, viruses circulate the globe within about 3 or 4 weeks. And so we've already had three viruses circulating, and COVID-19, this is data from America, was circulating, had its peak on the 22nd of March. And that means that people were probably at peak infection 10 days before, so the 12th of March. And then the population in America cleared the virus, most of them, within 10 days, and then the virus is gone. And so these results were presented on the 17th of April and from the 12th of April. So there is absolutely no need for lockdown. Now, what I'm happy to say is that people in immunology knew that there was actually no need for the original lockdown because it was well known from China that the 50% of the people were over 80 in China and in Italy and around the world. And there were countries that didn't lock down, like Taiwan and South Korea. This was already in February and March. So we have never in the hundreds of years of infectious diseases quarantined healthy people. Yeah. So because they knew that this affected, so some actually influenza viruses can affect young people, right? But it happens that this one affected elderly people. But what's really shocking and what I want to publicize is it's well known in immunology, you can take preventative measures to boost your own immune system so that even if you were a little bit malnourished or run down, that if you take vitamin D, vitamin C, and zinc, your immune system will be boosted. And also if you eat good nutrition, so that if you come across the virus, you will get it, you will have hardly any symptoms, you will clear the virus, and you will actually contribute to the immune people. So if you were to say to quarantine people for just in their homes, elderly people for a few weeks, then the other 90% of the population would come across the virus. About 80 or 90% of people, if they protect their immune systems, will not have any symptoms. They won't even know they have it. And then the virus will not circulate anymore. So that when the elderly, which could have been the end of April, come out of the quarantine, the virus is actually stopped in its tracks, right? So you can see that when influenza B had cleared the globe from that graph, it's not there anymore. And the reason is that people, the immune system clears this virus, it's gone. And people develop immunity. And it turns out as well, which is very significant, is the first so this is the severe acute respiratory disease, you know, with SARS-CoV-1 was in 2003. And this is now called, the other name is SARS-CoV-2. So in 2003, that circulated the globe. And they initially started to have a bit of a scare. But the World Health Organization has said that globally, the number of deaths from the first SARS in 2003 globally was 770 deaths. 770 in the world. But what that means, and there has been two more circulating since 2003, and when I looked into it, between 7% and 15% of the global population already had antibodies to these viruses. So that means what Ireland, RTE, and people are calling the number of cases, that even before this COVID-19 came, if you tested people for antibodies, between 7 and 15% of the Irish population would have had antibodies. So in our case, you would have 400,000 people. So what they're reporting is the number of cases of like 400,000 trying to scare people. They're actually people who developed immunity to the last SARS virus, and they would have immunity now. And also for, we'll say, the other 90%, a lot of people might have low level of antibodies, and it's also understood that some blood groups mightn't actually have antibodies in their serum, but actually they don't, the virus doesn't get into their cells, so they haven't developed immune response. But when they see COVID again, they are some of the people that have no symptoms because they don't have the receptor for the virus.
So that's Professor Dolores Cahill, Martin, something we're not allowed to hear, actually, because YouTube took it down and Business Insider did a whole story about why it had been taken down. Let's have a listen now to another one of these that's been taken down, another expert on the virus we're not allowed to hear from. This is Professor Knut Witkowski, and this was filmed by Journeyman Pictures, which is an old-style British production company. They decided they wanted to go around the world and find all sorts of expert opinions, and that was taken down by YouTube too. So let's have a listen to a clip from there.
Contact tracing. So following those who are cases and see what their context is, are things that have always been done to control epidemics, that was very successful also with smallpox. That is a reasonable thing to do, but to say that children should stay at home and can't go to school, that people cannot go out and eat, should not meet, all of these things are not reasonable.
So, Martin, I'd also like to play to you something which we were going to play in the first hour, I didn't have time to, but this is Udo Ulfkotti. His book actually was in German. He confessed to having worked for many years as a German journalist in a national paper for the Central Intelligence Agency. His book is called Prestitutes, and it's now out in English just in the last couple of months. Due to the work of some people from the 9/11 Truth Campaign, the former 9/11 Truth Campaign. The book is called Prestitutes, How the CIA Buys the News. So let's have a listen to the confession of Udo Ulfkotti now.
It is not right what I have done in the past to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia, and it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, and because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so. Well, people like me, I became honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States. Just why? Just because I write pro-American. I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. And so I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors.
Well, thank you, Udolf Ukoti, because Martin, you know, you and I know that he died, didn't he, about 6 months after publishing that book, in rather strange circumstances. I mean, he's really talking about groups like the Atlantic Bridge, which they start off as the idea is, oh, you know, if you want better contacts over the other side of the Atlantic, join this little group. All of a sudden, you find yourself as a journalist. As soon as you go against these people, you find yourself out of the profession like he did and possibly dead.
Well, that's right. And that's far more sinister in many ways than having your video taken down on YouTube. The CIA has dominated the mainstream media in the West. The intelligence services in the West are constantly manipulating public opinion through social media and through mainstream media. But most people do not realize how active these organizations actually are.
Okay, the book has now been translated into English. The publisher is, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page, at thisweek.org.uk. It's published by Progressive Press. They were the publishers of Webster Tarpley's excellent book about the September the 11th attacks. So it's Prestitutes Embedded in the Pay of the CIA, A Confession from the Profession by Udo Ufkoti. Well done to Udo for actually having the courage to come out and explain to the public that actually he's been bought and paid for, and effectively he was a prostitute for the American CIA, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, of course, we've got similar organisations here, the Integrity Initiative, the Institute for Statecraft. They basically have paid journalists who they basically feed stories to, basically anti-Chinese and anti-Russian stories. That's the usual fodder these days. And most people don't realise that this level of manipulation is going on, but the evidence is there for those who look.
And it is, isn't it? Because it looks like all the expert opinions that are against the prevailing narrative, in other words, anti-China, etc., are just simply stifled. And journalists like me that are trying to do that criticism are also now I've been removed from the airwaves. I was removed. My career was taken away quite a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago. So I have to do it as a volunteer now. But even that, it seems, is not going to be possible unless Pat Hart from BCFM changes his mind and puts us back on air. We hope very much that he will do that as soon as possible. But also censored, Martin, is rather more sinister, is this Max Egan report from the Christchurch Mosque massacre in 2019. So let's have a listen to part of his censored report. I mean, maybe every week we should just do another bit of whole section on what's been censored this week. And this one's from Max Egan in 2019 on the Christchurch Mosque massacre.
Many of these hits, I suspect, are carried out by trained assassins who are, in fact, MK Ultra victims. And this guy wasn't trained very well. I mean, he was a bit of a klutz. He dropped his entire cache of magazines as soon as he got into the hall, and they scattered all over the hall. He had to keep running back for them and made a lot of mistakes in the way he ran this operation. And that's why we've got so much insight into what's really going on here. But you have to be prepared to look at it with the right eyes and put all of this argument about CGI and all this stuff out of your mind for the moment and just look at what the video is showing you. When he first gets in the car, he drives out of the driveway, and right there on his left is a red car. Remember the woman in red from The Matrix? Red is often used in these MKUltra operations. There's a red car right there on his left as he pulls out. Then he goes out of the driveway, he turns left, and right there as he turns left, there is another red car, indicating that is the way for him to go. And then he gets to this one section where I think there's two red cars and a white car, and he pulls over on the left, and he waits 1 full minute by the side of the road. While he's waiting on the side of the road, a woman, appears to be a woman, wearing tan pants and a red coat, walks up. She's got some tag hanging around her neck, and he gives her a little bit of a signal, a bit of a wave with his fingers. It's kind of a, yeah, I'm your guy, sort of a signal. Like you're out there doing some shady deal in a car park, and you want someone to know that you're the guy they've got to come and give the money to. That's sort of a wave, just an acknowledgement. And as soon as she gets to the vehicle, he reaches down, and he turns on the flashing strobe light on his gun. Then he continues on and he drives down the road. Then when he gets to the block the mosque is on, the music in the car changes to British Grenadiers, a marching military song. So here he is, now he's marching off to war. And he drives down the road, continues driving down the road, and you find that there's a man standing by a driveway in a full red tracksuit, like he's attending a pit stop or something in a racetrack. He's in full red, red pants, red jacket to let him know that's the driveway he turns into. He turns into the driveway, does a bunch of little shuffles around, does a U-turn at the end of the driveway, comes back out, parks in the driveway, directly pointing towards a red car. As he's doing that, he gives a little thumbs up to a couple of guys, three guys who are walking across the driveway. He gets out of his car. He takes his AR-15 with him. He gets a shotgun out of the back. Then he walks out. He walks along the footpath. As soon as he walks past that car, a red marker becomes visible in the garden on the left. As soon as he sees that red marker, he begins firing.
So that's Max Egan's censored video, really explaining the very strong evidence that the shooter at the Christchurch mosque massacre was effectively doing a military operation. He was being managed by handlers who were on site, Martin. I mean, this is explosive stuff, really, because the Royal Commission is just looking into this over in New Zealand. We've heard that he has pleaded guilty, so there will not be very little of a proper trial to find out and to question him and quiz him and have lots of potential witnesses come forward at the trial to look it deeper into who was helping him.
Well, I mean, we know from the information that we've gathered over many years about the Gladio networks in Western Europe that the Western intelligence services routinely engage in false flag terrorism. So it would be rather surprising if this wasn't a false flag terrorist attack. It's sort of unusual for New Zealand, but of course it's a reminder that wherever you live, whoever you are, the big boys are not going to let you live peacefully. And of course, similar sort of stuff happened with the, I think there's very similar, lot of similarities between this attack and what happened in Norway with Breivik. Breivik didn't act on his own, and I don't suppose this guy acted on his own either. And that's because basically terrorism is orchestrated by Western intelligence services.
Well, the manifesto is also banned in New Zealand, as well as the video. It's even a criminal offence, apparently, for journalists to possess either, which means that it's almost impossible to really commentate on it, unless, I suppose, a journalist is to go abroad to do their research, maybe to Australia or somewhere, and then fly back to New Zealand with the article completed. That's the only way they can legally do it in New Zealand. Well, the idea of this black sun is on the very front of his manifesto, and I wonder what this black sun is. It's certainly, I know, something that was been linked to Satanism and also particularly to the Nazis, but I thought I'd see if I could find someone who's done a bit of research on what it is, and I came across this guy called Aerith Harger, who's a Portuguese writer and artist, and here he describes what he believes the black sun is all about.
The black sun symbol appears in the castle during the 20th century, during the 1930s and 1940s renovations and remodulations of the structure of the castle conducted by the Nazis and Heinrich Himmler himself. To be more precise, the symbol appears in the former SS General's Hall, Übergruppen Führersei. This is highly convenient. The symbol is made of 12 radial so-called Sieg runes, a Nazi recreation of the S rune Suelo. The SS initials are two S runes. Suelo literally means sun. It's a rune that represents the rays of the sun, light, hope, guidance, goal setting, and success. It's directly connected to the sun wheel symbol as a symbol of power and perseverance. You have to take in mind that the black sun clearly has pagan symbols, old ancient symbols of power. But the black sun as a whole isn't a pagan symbol. It's a new symbol created by the Nazis. Sieg runes are runes of victory, and this concept of victory was added to the Suelo rune because of the Nazis. Suelo might not have had anything to do with victory. While to the Nazis, the Sieg runes, which are other runes, was clearly a symbol for victory. So the Black Sun might have meant to the Nazis a symbol of victory represented 12 times. The symbol has historically remained prominent in neo-Nazi occult circles. It's frequently used more generally by neo-Nazi far-right white nationalists. This symbol started to be used by some Satanists as well, which might mean that the Black Sun symbol in more contemporary times gained an association with the phenomenon of the eclipse, which in mythology has been connected with the upcoming end of the world and or with a drastic change approaching.
Well, interesting analysis there by Aris Haga over in Portugal, who's a writer and artist on the Black Sun, Martin. But one of the most interesting things he teases out there is he says that actually historically there's no record of this at all in pagan culture. This is something that was just cooked up in the 30s by the Nazis.
Well, I mean, most tradition is actually modern invention. You know, think of the kilt in Scotland, which was basically invented in the 19th century by English romantics. And of course, you know, the idea that you're tapping into some ancient force is quite prevalent.
Actually, I mean, the Nazis were very good at that, weren't they? There's quite a lot of their culture, which was just simply myth invented for convenience.
Well, yes, and what you do is you work with what's already there. The generalized hostility towards Jews, for example, becomes sharpened into absolutely brutal killing anti-Semitism. But, of course, they're working with prejudices which go back hundreds of years.
I know Ronald Hutton at Bristol University, I'm not sure if he's still there, he's talked about this whole idea of this kind of remanufacturing of pagan culture, which doesn't really bear any relevance to the reality from history.
Well, I mean, the point is that people are allowed to make up new stuff, aren't they? I mean, you can't stop them. They're going to. And that doesn't, but of course they can't claim credibly that this stuff is really related to ancient beliefs. Ancient beliefs were very, very varied. We know a lot about them and a lot we don't know. But of course modern people want to have ideas as well. And they basically take from the history of humanity the variety of different things that people have believed. Modern people spatch together their own versions.
Well, particularly neo-Nazis creating their kind of neo-Nazi mythos, you know, this idea that what they're doing is somehow been going on throughout history, which is laughable, really, particularly in this case, the, you know, symbol of the Black Sun. But anyway, the Black Sun, I mean, I suppose, you know, the sun, it is a bit of a tenuous link, I suppose, but the sun is like a hydrogen bomb, the atom bomb. So we're going to talk now a bit more about, we talked about him last week, about Klaus Fuchs. Martin, I think you originally kind of brought him in as an interesting figure in history, but he certainly was. And here we're going to hear from Oxford University physics professor Frank Close, who's written a book on Fuchs, and he gave a talk at Bristol University towards the end of the last year. And this here he explains how Klaus Fuchs, the originally German, who he fled Germany before the war started, and how he began his atom spying career after Operation Barbarossa when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union.
He started sending these secrets from the very beginning when he started at Birmingham in May 1941. He continued when he moved across the States in New York. For the year in New York, he passed the secrets on several occasions, and he carried on doing it while he was at Los Alamos. So by the time the bomb was actually used, Stalin knew all about it. And indeed, after the war, Fuchs came back to Harwell, the new nuclear center in Oxfordshire. It was in Berkshire in those days, and was the go-to scientist on Britain's totally secret atomic bomb program of our own. And he continued passing that across to the Soviet Union.
I mean, why did Britain need a bomb? Surely we'd been sharing all our expertise with the United States when it came to the Manhattan Project. Wasn't Britain privy to all of that too? I mean, it seemed a bit strange for Churchill to do a deal with Roosevelt during the war, saying, well, you can develop it over in the United States, without actually guaranteeing that the technology was available and the bombs, if necessary, were available to Britain too.
Well, that is an interesting political story. Yes, Churchill had done a deal with Roosevelt, all verbal. Roosevelt, of course, dies. Truman was the new president.
Ah.
But more important was that the Americans felt that they had paid for it. And the McMahon Act was passed, which basically said that the Americans were going to keep all nuclear know-how to themselves, and even their allies, Britain, were going to be frozen out of information on what took place post-war. The Americans basically wanted to have hegemony over atomic weaponry. That is why Britain had to go it alone.
So that was Professor Frank Close there, the author of Trinity, The Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History. That is his spying career that began after the invasion of the Soviet Union, which I suppose he justified, really, Martin, by thinking to himself, well, hang on, we're now in the war with the Russians. I want to make sure that the Russians have got a share of this technology too.
Well, Fuchs was the son of a Protestant pastor. He was a German. He got involved in anti-Nazi politics as a teenager, and he gravitated towards the Communist Party, which was one of the big parties in Germany at the time.
But he got his physics degree.
And were opposed to the Nazis.
He got his physics degree here in Bristol.
Yeah, well, he then had to flee, and he got involved in nuclear...
Hang on. No, he didn't flee from Bristol. He was...
No, he fled
because
from Germany.
He was a British citizen. He was exiled to Canada.
Yeah. But, I mean, he was originally German, and he'd come to Britain. But he had communist sympathies, which he obviously managed to hide pretty successfully, because he carried on being promoted to fairly senior positions where he got access to the material which he passed to the Soviets.
So one of the most incredible twists in this tale is the way that the British atomic bomb experts had to actually go and visit Fuchs in prison in order to successfully design their nuclear weapons and hydrogen bomb in the 1950s.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, that's international superpower politics for you.
So let's have another listen to Professor Frank Close, the author of Trinity, The Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History now.
An atomic bomb, although horrible, is limited in what it can do. A hydrogen bomb is limitless. I mean, in principle, the sun is an example of a hydrogen reaction going on, and it's just a matter of how much you can bring together to make it. The hydrogen bomb is ghastly. And yes, by 1946, when he came back from Los Alamos, Fuchs was privy to the beginnings of the ideas on the hydrogen bomb. I found out that indeed he made a patent on a particular technique that was used in the eventual hydrogen bomb. And by 1950, he probably knew as much about the hydrogen bomb as anybody did. At that stage, I should say, nobody knew how to make one work. That was not solved until after Fuchs had been in jail. So Fuchs didn't know anything about the eventual hydrogen bomb, but he certainly was a world expert in some of the early stages that would have been needed. And I do have some evidence that the head of the British atomic program, William Penny, later Lord Penny, visited Fuchs in jail in order to get information from him about a hydrogen bomb when Britain decided in 52-ish that we were going to develop a hydrogen bomb. And basically, Penny had nobody who knew anything about what a hydrogen bomb was. And so Fuchs, he had to go and consult. I mean, these are so ironical that you couldn't make it up.
So this is amazing, isn't it? So the head of the hydrogen bomb project really was consulting Fuchs whilst he was in jail.
That's indeed the case. So Fuchs was, now look at it from Fuchs's perspective. He has given everything all along. He's confessed, he's helped the British hydrogen bomb project, and then the Brits remove his British citizenship. And so he felt that he had double jeopardy. And so at the end of his jail sentence, he then left Britain and went and lived in East Germany, which is the final irony, because the way I sort of drew the analogy, the Russians must have been laughing, because the person in Britain who knew more than anybody about how to make an atomic and beginnings of hydrogen bomb, we'd banged him up in jail. It was like paying $100 million for a star sent to Ford and then shooting him in the kneecap.
Well, I mean, maybe the British reaction was largely driven by the Americans being so angry at Britain and at Fuchs for leaking all these secrets.
Well, that is certainly true. There was a huge fallout, if that's the right metaphor in this circumstance. But the Americans had cut us off, you know, from atomic know-how in 1946. And we, by 1950, were beginning to show that they couldn't really do some things without our help. And a lot of negotiations have been going on for us to get back in bed with them, effectively. And the Fuchs debacle completely put the kibosh on that. For some time. I think it was not until the late 50s that things got back on an even keel. So there's a lot of political fallout as a result of the Fuchs affair.
So that's Professor Frank Close from Oxford University Physics Department, who's written this book, Trinity, the Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History, who just happened to get his degree here at Bristol University, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think Fuchs would basically say that he did the right thing, because if he hadn't given the Soviets access to nuclear secrets, it's quite possible that Churchill and Truman would have nuked the USSR. We've now got the documents. They were definitely discussing it. And knowing that the other side had got the bomb basically led to a situation of mutually assured destruction, which supposedly saved us all in the Cold War.
I mean didn't MacArthur also threaten to use a nuclear bomb in Korea?
Well, he did, yes. I mean, in actual fact, the US has threatened to use nuclear weapons, I believe it's up to 50 times since World War II. And if the other side hadn't had nuclear weapons, they would have done, possibly. So Fuchs would basically say, I don't regret anything. Just as other people, for example, who worked at Bletchley Park, gave the Soviet military the order of battle for the Germans at Kursk, because they'd broken the German codes. And the people years later came forward, yes, I told the Russians what the order of battle was so that they would win. And I don't regret it.
So over the last few weeks, we've been following, haven't we? Particularly last week, we did a whole thing on the Nazi atom bomb, effectively evidence now that surfaced that the Nazis, maybe one or even two possible nuclear tests took place, one in October 1944. Anyway, the evidence now has come to light, basically official documents, intelligence reports saying that they've got all these interviews with people who witnessed it. But anyway, I thought I'd have another look at that this week, and also because we're looking at various things to do with this Black Sun, this kind of Nazi idea. And Joseph Farrell is the author of a book called Reich of the Black Sun, where he looks at some of these Nazi secrets, the Nazi technology, which was then passed on to mainly to the United States by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, at the end of the war, as very important deals done at the close during VE Day. So let's have a listen now to Joseph Farrell, the author of Reich of the Black Sun.
After the war, in the London Daily Telegraph, right after we have dropped the first atom bomb on Hiroshima, the British London Telegraph ran this short little article. Nazis atom bomb plans, Britain ready a year ago. And the text is reproduced in Reich of the Black Sun. And basically it says that during the period from August to October of 1944, the entire British Isles were under a secret alert to the possibility of the Germans using an atom bomb on Great Britain. In other words, the British were expecting something, and only after the war did they reveal it. At the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi armaments minister, Albert Speer, was asked a question by the chief American prosecutor, Henry Jackson. Quote, a village, a small village, was provisionally erected with temporary structures, and in it approximately 20,000 Jews were put. By means of this newly invented weapon of destruction, these 20,000 people were eradicated almost instantaneously. and in such a way that there was no trace left of them, that it developed, the explosive developed, temperatures of from 400 degrees to 500 degrees centigrade and destroyed them without leaving any trace at all. Do you know about that experiment? Speer. No. And I consider it utterly improbable. If we had such a weapon under preparation, I should have known about it. Unquote. Now, it's interesting that Speer says that, because as I'm going to get into in a moment, most of the super sensitive secret research of the Third Reich was conducted under the auspices and security jurisdiction of the SS. And in fact, toward the end of the war, Speer didn't have knowledge of most of this sensitive stuff. So it's not surprising that he doesn't know about it. But it's interesting to read Jackson's description of how the Germans are testing whatever it is that they're testing. They're building mock cities. They're putting living biological material there, in this case, live human beings, to study the effects of this weapon. So clearly, we're dealing with a weapon that is so unusual it requires this kind of testing. It's not a conventional explosive.
Anyway, that's Joseph Farrell there, presentation about his book, The Reich of the Black Sun. I mean, whether that's an atomic bomb, obviously, well, it doesn't seem like it, if it's only 400 degrees to 500 degrees Celsius, Martin, but it is quite feasible, it seems, that the Nazis were quite happy to try these and test these people out, or these weapons out, on live human beings. And some would even point to the US attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the atomic weapons as effectively live tests that didn't really need to take place.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things you could pick up there. I mean, obviously, the main thread here is that the Nazis had developed nuclear technology, but also, of course, some deal was done by which it was transferred to the Western powers for use on Japan. These are very murky waters, but I think there's pretty clear evidence going back many years that substantial sections of the Nazi secret state were basically taken over by the Western powers, and as NATO was put together in the 1940s and 1950s, plenty of people from the Nazi era were prominent in that in what developed.
We're going to listen to James Perloff now again. I've sort of discovered him over the last few weeks. And whilst I don't agree with everything he says, I think he has got some interesting insight, particularly into Christian Zionism. And we're going to hear a bit about that now. But Martin, what is it that makes this Christian Zionism so pernicious? I mean, he looks, for example, at, the idea back in the late 1800s that there was a definite attempt to almost preempt the Balfour Declaration to say, well, there is this whole strain of very well-funded Christianity, this new strain, particularly in the United States and in Britain, that says that the theology is that the Jews must return to Israel. And then all of a sudden, abracadabra, the Balfour Declaration, and in the Second World War, the creation of the Israeli state. I mean, do you think feasible that these sorts of things are arranged, maybe even decades beforehand?
Well, the fact of the matter is, and it's widely understood in mainstream circles, that a lot of the decisions about creation of the State of Israel and the Balfour Declaration were taken by people who had Christian fundamentalist views of one kind or another. Lloyd George was persuaded to support the Balfour Declaration because he'd been brought up on the reading the Old Testament in Welsh as a young man. And everybody thinks that they know the Holy Land because they, Lloyd George himself said, I felt I knew these places better than I knew my own country of North Wales. And I think that the Zionists have exploited this particular strand in Christian thinking. And, it's not really that much of a mystery, that these two strands of thinking have been complementary.
Yeah, Lord Palmerston is another one who was one of the first sort of the idea of the Zionists, and he was certainly doing that, pushing it through the British Empire of his day.
Yeah, I mean, the British Empire is responsible for the creation of the State of Israel. In hour one, Steve was saying, well, what's it got to do with the British, what goes on in the State of Israel? Well, we created the State of Israel 100 years ago by the Balfour Declaration and in 1948, and the people of Palestine lost out as a result of that.
Well, some would say, Martin, some would say we were forced to do it by Jewish terrorists.
Well, there were definitely terrorists involved in the creation of the State of Israel, but Ord Wingate, who was the original commander of Brigade 77 in Burma, trained and organised them. And then they went on to kill British soldiers so that they could get their independence. And, of course, that's not really the Board of Deputies of British Jews today regard those people as heroes. But they killed plenty of British military personnel back in the day. They were terrorists, I suppose they were. They would see themselves as freedom fighters. But as you know, there's all sorts of perceptions of these different things throughout history.
Senator, let's listen now to James Perloff and his talk about Christian Zionism as something that he's studied pretty carefully, and he's looking at it as a sort of a way to not only to get eventually a potential battle going in the Middle East, you know, possibly even a third world war, but also a new world government and what he says calls a new world religion.
Let's talk about how this fits into the world government scenario. You know, the Bible does talk about the beast governing the world. We need a world government. Every government's got a capital. Our capital in America is in Washington, but the capital of the world government is going to be in Jerusalem. Menachem Begin, the first prime minister of Israel, said as much. The Rothschilds have always intended that the center of their world government, their police state, would be Jerusalem. And this is why Theodor Herzl began hosting these Zionist congresses in Switzerland in 1897. And this is why you had the Balfour Declaration of 1917, whereby the British government promised the Zionist Federation, this declaration was specifically addressed to Lord Walter Rothschild, that the British would establish a homeland for Jews in Palestine. This is the beginning of modern Israel and the modern Zionist state. And this is in return for bringing America into the First World War on Britain's side. The official story given the public was that it's in return for, I think it was Wiseman, developing a gunpowder the British could use, but the real deal behind the scenes, and this is affirmed by the Secretary of the Zionist Congress, Samuel Landman, that the real deal was they would bring Woodrow Wilson and the Americans in. And of course, our declaration of war was in 1917, the same year as the Balfour Declaration. So that was the deal. That was the trade-off. That was the quid pro quo. Samuel Untermyer, who we'll be getting into tonight, and of course, Edward Mandelhaus, and the whole Bankster dynasty, Jacob Schiff, and all those people. Baruch, who he appointed, you know, head of the War Industries Board and made hundreds of millions of dollars in war profits for goods that were never delivered to our soldiers on the front, who were making $30 a month. Judge Brandeis was the one who Samuel Untermyer blackmailed Wilson to put him on the Supreme Court, like so many people do. And that became really consolidated as a Council of Foreign Relations at the end of World War One, and that before it formalized it. And of course, the councils, which is subject of my book, The Shadows of Power, produced the majority of our secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, CIA directors, and treasury secretaries. But this is the Bankster Committee. These are the guys who formed the Federal Reserve, and they secured all kinds of promises from Woodrow Wilson before he ran for president. And remember, the guy had no political background before he ran, except for 1 year as governor of New Jersey, which is just token, so he'd have some kind of political back. Recruited Teddy Roosevelt to break up the Republicans in 1912 so that Wilson could get elected with only 42% of the popular vote. But anyway, to bring us back to the New World Order and this idea of Jerusalem and the Zionism taking over, the Zionists, the Rothschilds, knew they could not do this without the consent of the Christian community. And to get the Christians to consent, that's where the Scofield Reference Bible came in. That was its purpose, was to change Christian theology. It was what sold millions of copies. And I want to draw our connections again here. 1917 is the big year of publication. 1917 is the year of the Balfour Declaration. So now in the minds of your Protestant Christian, what's happening? Scofield is saying God has ordained that the Jews must return to Palestine. Oh, well, England has just promised the Jews they'll have a homeland in Palestine the very same year. To the unsuspecting Christian, it would appear that Scofield's Bible was showing things prophetically happen right before their eyes. God's will is happening, and Scofield's Bible is on the money because it shows the events that are happening in the world are actually being are taking place as we see. All these things are happening simultaneously. It's a clever plan. It's not a miracle. It is actually satanic,
yeah.
But it is designed to trick Christians into thinking that it's miraculous and it's God's hand moving these events. And of course, some people would say, well, God's hand is even moving as evil takes place. But the yeah. point being that this is not the will of God being fulfilled. This is a satanic endeavor.
Well, Martin, the obvious comparison, I suppose, is with the creation of ISIS. This idea that, you know, that the ISIS is some kind of prophesied thing in the Quran. And this is actually quite a good way to hook in people who have got some faith, maybe not necessarily that they've checked in and read the Quran or read the Bible. But this is, seems to be something which is actually much bigger than we realize. These very deliberate attempts to sucker people in order to get them to think that this is but it's based on a particular interpretation. In fact, in this case, a fake interpretation of the Bible and a fake interpretation of the Quran.
Well, I mean, what you've got is a lot of manipulation at every level. You've got manipulation of people who are genuine believers, and you've got manipulation of people on basis of you know, vested interests of one kind and another. The Christian Zionists, incidentally, are generally anti-Semitic. The belief is that the state of Israel must be allowed to exist because it will then provoke the end times, a final showdown. And in the end times, the Jews will either convert to Christianity or they will be eliminated. In other words, it's a basically anti-human ideology. And not very much to do with the chap who made the Sermon on the Mount.
Also, I thought we'd finish off this show by looking at a book by Kevin Gillaly. I mean, his book is called Killing Us Softly. He's for many years he's been talking about depopulation, deliberate programs to depopulate the planet, and vaccines apparently are included in that plan. So let's have a listen now to Kevin Gillaly. We interviewed him in October 2018, about a year and a half ago.
The population in a natural state would double every 20 to 30 years. We cannot survive the next doubling from 7 billion to 14 billion, which would happen in 20 to 30 years. And had they not started to subvert fertility in 1945, we would already be a collapsed civilization. We would have long exceeded 10 billion, which is considered to be the absolute maximum.
This is what the elite think, by the way.
And not even sustainably. So we may be able to feed 10 billion people for a number of years or decades, but not sustainably. We would do it at the cost of all planetary boundaries. We would destroy nature.
Okay, so you've talked about the poison in our foods, which is rather worrying. At least we can check this out, you know, against the list of various chemicals. But what are the other methods?
Vaccines, for instance, which nowadays constitute the new front of the depopulation genocide. Why? Having identified these endocrine disruptors as depopulation poisons, we have forced governments to begin the process of taking them out of the system. So they are reforming the chemical environment, but they're attempting now to substitute these covert chemical methods of depopulation with mandatory vaccination programs. In other words, with biological methods of depopulation, which is why vaccines are being mandated right, left, and center.
Well, I know in the United States, there's something like 55 vaccines supposed to be injected into every child before the age of 5. I don't think most other countries are quite as excessive, but that does seem like a lot.
Yes, in fact, the United States has 75 vaccines. Canada is almost there
well. Last time I looked was a few years ago. I mean, so vaccines, we've got poisons in our food and poisons leaching into our food from the packaging. What else?
And we have GMOs, for instance, which have built-in mechanisms of undermining our fertility and immunity. So in other words, scientists have designed these GMOs to produce enzymes that are destructive either to our reproductive system or to the immune system. And this is, again, a method that is used throughout the world. It is particularly relevant for the developing world because countries in the developing world cannot pay for this program. This program of controlling population growth is extremely expensive, and Western nations, the wealthy nations, no longer want to foot the bill.
Kevin Galeley there speaking 18 months ago or so to us on this program. His book, Killing Us Softly, looking at vaccines and deliberate depopulation agendas. Now, this is a reason I bring this up, Martin, is because when and if there is a vaccine to the COVID-19, we're looking at something called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. And I've seen various reports on the BBC talking about this technology. They call it gene editing technology. So this would not be an Edward Jenner style vaccine like smallpox was and cowpox, you know, 100 or so years ago. I'd like to point out, there's a really interesting article about this CRISPR technology used in gene editing vaccines, and it's in a publication called The Atlantic. The headline is "The CRISPR Baby Scandal Gets Worse by the Day." The creation of the world's first gene-edited infants was full of technical errors and ethical blunders. This is from December 2018, not long after we did that interview. And what they're saying is, before last week, few people had heard the name of He Jiankui, but on November the 25th, a young Chinese researcher became the centre of global firestorm when it emerged he'd allegedly made the first CRISPR-edited babies, twin girls named Lulu and Nana. Antonio Reglado broke the story for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Technology Review, the same, incidentally, same publication that published that amazing article in the middle of March saying we're not going back to normal and explaining what was going to be going on with these lockdowns around the world, almost as if they were being prophetic about it. But what they're saying is that there's many parts of this gene editing technology and the way it's being trialled, which is simply not it's not ethical. So first of all, he didn't address an unmet medical need. So they basically were saying was there was no need to do this. This was just experimenting on humans in a rather Dr. Mengele-like fashion. Then he's saying that the gene editing wasn't executed well. So the genes weren't edited properly. So there were a lot of claims made for this gene editing CRISPR software technology, which didn't actually do what they said. And then it also that there are new mutations, and it's unclear how they will affect these individuals that were created using this technology. Then there was problems with informed consent. In other words, the parents of these children weren't properly informed about what they were letting themselves in for. And then also the excessive amount of secrecy that he worked under. And a few people knew about his intentions but failed to stop him, even though they should have done according to law. And also he then sought ethical advice about this gene editing program. And then when he got that ethical advice, he then ignored it. So this is a type of technology, Martin, which is really starting to look very, very unethical. And the idea is that you're experimenting on human beings as well and editing their genes before they're even born.
Well, I'm not an expert, obviously, on this kind of technology. But, of course, there are huge question marks over all of this. As somebody who's trained in economics, I would say that Big Pharma is an oligopoly, which is basically controlling what goes on in this field, and that's there's an argument for the nationalisation of drug production, so that it isn't driven by profit motives, and that doesn't mean that bad things wouldn't happen, but at least it wouldn't be driven by the desire. I mean, there's a massive amount of money to be made from anybody who develops a vaccine.
Okay, I mean, some of the experts in the field talked about this experiment by He Jiankui from China. What they said The reaction was swift and negative. Apparently, the CRISPR pioneer, Jennifer Doudna, said she was horrified. NIH, National Institute for Health Director Francis Collins, said the experiment was profoundly disturbing. And Julian Savulescu, an ethicist who described these gene editing methods as a moral necessity, in some cases described this particular work on humans as monstrous.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, there's potential in this kind of technology for good. I mean, we want people to be trying to find new cures for things. But on the other hand, there's far too much vested interest in it from people who are looking just for a profit. And don't forget, you've also got military applications of all this technology. And you can be quite sure that the various militaries are looking into them.
That's right, biowarfare potentially.
Indeed. Well, as you know, coming all the way around the houses, there are two competing narratives about COVID-19 being a bioweapon. One coming from the Americans, saying that the Chinese have done this deliberately in order to try and wreck our economy, and the Chinese saying, no, you've done it deliberately to wreck our economy. And, of course, don't forget, as I said in the first hour, the international financial system started to crack up in September before coronavirus. So, in other words, they've now bailed this all out with massive amounts of money, and it's all covered by coronavirus. Are we doing it because of coronavirus? If it had collapsed without coronavirus, there'd have been big questions asked. Why are we bailing them out again? But, of course, because of the coronavirus, everybody thinks that's why they bailed the system out. But they started bailing the system out in the repo market in September. And as we said earlier, it may be that this whole virus developed earlier than in Wuhan. And it may have developed in the United States. It may have come from Fort Detrick by accident or by design. Whitney Webb's latest stuff suggests that it's probably actually they've allowed it to spread. They didn't do test and trace so that they can then have a lockdown. And that's what I think about the lockdown. If you don't do test and trace, you've got to do a lockdown. They didn't do test and trace, so they could have a lockdown. But the thing is, if you don't have a lockdown, if you haven't done test and trace, you're then in a position where you're not in control of the situation. The Chinese are in control of the virus inside their borders. As they go to war, they're going to make sure that all of their ships, for example, are virus-free, whereas it's quite clear that US ships are not virus-free. And this is going to be the terms of trade of this coming confrontation.
Well, one of the things I found so absolutely shocking about this CRISPR looking into it, I mean, I just came across it first watching something on the BBC about it, was that in the presentation, it was just presented as this wonderful little bit of technology that can go right into your genes, chop them like with a pair of scissors, and splice them in a very precise manner. But quite clearly, there's much more to it than that, Martin. And it's certainly quite considering using this technology as they're developing the vaccine for COVID-19.
Well, that is right. And what's happening is that favoured organisations close to Gates have been basically allowed to trial these new experimental vaccines, which are based on DNA, on human subjects, without going through the normal practice of experimenting with animals, because coronavirus is such a quick such an emergency that we can't go through the normal procedures for checking whether a vaccine's safe or not, and that is very suspicious, because if they come up with a vaccine very, very quickly and then make it mandatory, you can be pretty certain that they were probably behind the initial attack, but we will have to see.
Well, so CRISPR, would you like to guess what it stands for?
I've no idea.
That's a bit mean, isn't it? It's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. But this is the idea is that you get a protein that goes in and starts snipping away at DNA, and that, you know, this is a way of basically creating your own genomes. And this is a kind of
standard vaccine technology, in other words. So in other words, they're rushing this through. This is a great opportunity to rush through what was an experimental technology without proper safeguards.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll wind up by saying, I mean, remember back at the end of January, Martin, we reported on this New Delhi University report that said that the COVID-19 virus, the genome that had been circulated around to the virology department at New Delhi University, and another Indian institute as well had a good old look at it, and they said within a few days they believed that it was a man-made, that it couldn't have appeared naturally, and that it had the AIDS and the SARS proteins inserted into basically what was a common cold virus.
Well, let's just think of this through logically and not without going on for too long. It could be that it's natural. Let's just accept that as possible. If it has been modified, it could have escaped by accident, either from the Wuhan laboratory or from Fort Detrick, which was closed down in July last year. The Americans have not been very clear about that. Why was Fort Detrick closed down this time last year? And the point I'd make about that is we do know that the anthrax, which was mailed to various decision makers in the US after the 9/11 attacks, definitely came from Fort Detrick. I would say it's pretty 100% a false flag attack, as was the 9/11 attack itself. Now, if you think that these people are capable of carrying out that kind of attack, which they are they capable of using a bioweapon to try and bring down the Chinese economy? Because that's World War III's got to happen. It might as well happen now. I think that's definitely an open question. The people say, oh, that's too convoluted. No, it's not. The Americans have been shouting from the rooftops that they want to bring down the Chinese economy. This is what's happened now. They've done it.
And also, you've got the Middle East and Hong Kong now as potential powder kegs that could draw in the superpowers into a much wider war.
Well, and also, of course, the other main thing that's happened this week that people need to pay attention to is the number of Iranian tankers which are heading across the Atlantic to Venezuela. And the Americans are saying, and the British are involved in this as well, we've got a frigate out there, we're going to interdict these tankers, which will end up with a shooting war with the Venezuelan Navy. And, of course, the Iranians have said, if you attack our ships, we're going to attack your ships in the Gulf. So get ready for this, people in Britain. Your British ships in the Gulf are going to be attacked if we attack the Iranian ships on the way to Venezuela.
Sounds a little bit like the projection of power by the Royal Navy in medieval times, doesn't it?
Well, no, what it means is that most people in Britain are blissfully unaware that we are being dragged to war by our leaders, who are being dragged to war by the US leaders and by the Israeli leaders. They decide, we just do as they're told.
And it's all rather handy that much of our civil society, pressure groups and things like that, can't even meet because of the lockdown.
Well, indeed. And of course, what I'm suggesting is if this is a bio attack by the West, it's probably failed in terms of what they wanted to do to the Chinese. But what they want to do is also militarize their own society. And it gives them the excuse to do that. I'm not saying that's what's happened, but I think it could be. And the other thing is that just opportunistically, even if this was just a natural virus, it's quite clear that the deep state in the West is determined on a policy of confrontation with both China and Russia.
I mean, Martin, also, I mean, if they are determined, it would make a lot of sense, wouldn't it, to get rid of dissenting voices within the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, that's what's been going on. Of course it has. The Israeli embassy are ultimately behind these what's going on with the Labour Party, as we know from the sting that was done by Al Jazeera some years ago, where the Mossad agent openly boasted that that's what they were doing. And anybody who's running the Labour Party who didn't watch that just needs the idea that the Israelis don't try and intervene in our politics is frankly absurd. They do. And of course, the Israeli state is funded by massive amounts of US taxpayer money. That taxpayer money then gets spent on psychological warfare operations against the British state to ensure that we go along with the big plan. And of course, by and large, our own deep state is deeply enmeshed with both other sets of criminals.
Okay, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's Steve Smith, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and our sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I am on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m., but so far it hasn't appeared. We'll hope it does. next Monday. We'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the politics show at the old time of 5 o'clock, live, online, next Friday, and uploaded as a podcast afterwards. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And there's a note on the sleeve of this record that says materialism is slowly but surely destroying everything that makes life worth living. There are people fighting to change things before it's too late. Join them, and gives the phone numbers for Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. This is Children of Dub.